8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis, everyone. First off, I can't find Guy Weddle, so I don't know where he is, which is very out of character for Mr. Weddle. Hopefully he'll show up and we'll add him to the conversation. If not, then something must be up, because I haven't heard from him, and I know he loves H.P. Lovecraft, and I'm pretty sure Irene didn't hit Philadelphia, so I know there was an earthquake there earlier in the week. That weird earthquake that, like, shook Washington, D.C. and Virginia, and it even shook Philadelphia. So I haven't heard anything from him, so hopefully he'll show up and we'll add him to the conversation. Until then, we'll keep the show must go on. So anyway, it's been a weird week. Hurricane Irene, it just passed me in Florida. It went straight by, thank goodness. It sucked up all the rain. We're in a drought on the panhandle. All the rain's been sucked up into a vortex everywhere. There's no storms anywhere around here. But it looks like we're in a worse drought now. And I've been watching Hurricane Irene on the weather map. It's just like this big, giant vortex sucking up every storm everywhere. So now there's, like, no storms here. So it looks like it's going to rain in forever. Irene stole them all. Well, hopefully all our listeners are safe out there from North Carolina up to the New York area, and that you're safe and prepared for Irene. So, and then of course the earthquake, luckily I don't believe anybody was hurt, but I wish it would have shook Washington, D.C. a little bit more, but that's just me. So tonight's guest, and hopefully Mr. Weddle will drop in. If not, then I hope he's all right. We'll see what happens. We'll see if he turns up. Tonight's guest is Venger Satanis, Cult of Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft Tribute of the Weird. Tonight, we're going to be discussing H.P. Lovecraft and his life and a tribute to him. Today I watched a lot of movies from about Lovecraft. I've always about Lovecraft. I have a lot of his books, and I definitely have always considered him a master of horror. First off, I want to read a couple of quotes before we get to our guest. The first one is from H.P. Lovecraft himself, and it says, "The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown." That's H.P. Lovecraft. I have one more quote here from Stephen King. "Now that time has given us some perspective on his work, I think it is beyond doubt that H.P. Lovecraft has yet to be surpassed as the 20th century's greatest practitioner of the classic horror tale." And that's from Stephen King, who H.P. Lovecraft definitely influenced among many authors. It's just amazing how he's touched as far as their writing. Robert Bloch, I know he had some correspondence with Robert E. Howard from Conan. We're going to get into his life and times in tribute tonight with Venger. Venger, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm alive. You could, Venger. Did I say your name right? Venger Satanis, right?
Yep. That is correct.
Cool. All right. Well, if you could, Venger, first off, tell us a little bit about yourself so the audience will, you know, be familiar with you a bit for people who may not know you.
Sure. I am the founder and leader of the Cthulhu Cults, which is, there's many different ways I could describe it, but it's a left-hand path, religion, magical society. A lot of it is based on H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos and other things like Satanism and Gnosticism and The Fourth Way by Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, chaos magic, things like that. And the Cthulhu cult, I created that in 2004, and it's still going. We've got a website, which is cultofcthulhu.net, and that's kind of our hub where you can find all of our writing, links to other stuff. Primarily, our mission is to awaken ourselves and as much of humanity as possible in order to bring the old ones back. So, it's very, very fitting with the Lovecraft tribute and in keeping with the master of the 20th century's classic horror tale, H.P. Lovecraft.
All right. And if you could, if you would, tell us about Lovecraft, a little bit of a bio to start everyone out, because I know a lot of people know who H.P. Lovecraft is, but there may be a few who don't, and of course the ones that should be smited with tentacles, but nonetheless, if you could, give us a little summary just to start us off to familiarize everybody with who H.P. Lovecraft is.
Sure. H.P. Lovecraft, born in 1890, and I believe he died in 1937. He was primarily known as a weird tale writer, or science fiction and horror, and a little bit fantasy writer. He wrote most of his tales were written in the 1920s and 30s. A lot of them were published in the pulp magazines of that time, like Weird Tales, Astounding Stories, Amazing Whatever. And he was kind of a weird guy, kind of a recluse. Had a lot of correspondences with people throughout the writing world. Didn't have a lot of contact with people like one-on-one. Because he was just kind of a weirdo, and he didn't fit in with people or society. And he was a dreamer, and more of the creative, artistic kind of writer. A lot of times he kept to himself, except when he would write these giant, like 10 and 20 page letters weekly to different people, like you mentioned, Robert E. Howard and August Derleth, a ton of other people, Robert Bloch, Ramsey Campbell, I'm sure, and Dalton F. Wong.
Yeah, and today I watched that, I'd seen it before, but I rewatched that documentary, it's H.P. Lovecraft's Fear of the Unknown, and it has like Guillermo del Toro and John Carpenter and all them in it. Really good documentary. I loved it. It was the second time I've seen it. But there was one interesting thing that I can't remember which one said it. It may have been Ramsey. But he said something about his mom used to tell neighbors that he was ugly. She would just tell neighbors that her kid's ugly. But it was like never come out of the house.
His father died when he was very young. I think when he was probably about five, maybe between five and seven. And then shortly after, I believe his mother died. And then he was sort of raised and taken care of I believe, by three aunts until eventually in his adult life they started dying off as well. And, yeah, his mother filled him with all sorts of ugly, and he was always tickly. He needed to be inside and sheltered and protected from things.
Well, when it comes to the basic theme of his stories, what is the basic intention that he's trying to get across as far as what is the central theme of most of his stories? I know it revolves around these beings, but if you could, in your own words, tell the audience exactly what the main theme is of most of his stories.
Sure. Well, cosmic horror is a big one, and I think his idea of cosmic horror stems from the notion that mankind is not at the center of things. And that even though we might be the best and brightest species on planet Earth, that considering the grand scope of the universe, we're relatively small and insignificant. And that insignificance, next to the grandiosity of the universe in whatever entities or beings are within that, or even outside of it, that kind of throws our insignificance into sharp relief and makes us feel even more small and meaningless. And I think that's what Lovecraft was trying to get at and portray. And that's the kind of horror that he was trying to evoke in his stories. That all the protagonists and the characters and everybody on Earth is just, in a way, sort of fooling themselves. They think that reality is one way, and that human beings are at the top of any possible food chain, and that society is always rational and logical and good and should just continue on forever. He had a wider perspective and a different kind of skewed perspective. He was kind of a misanthrope, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, and the Cult of Cthulhu, which is the name of your organization, so to speak, I'm having trouble differentiating between fiction and reality. Do you actually believe that there's truth on some level to his stories? I mean, there's something haunting about them and otherworldly that's just creepy, that more so than any other horror writer I've ever read. And I think it just seems like he's pulling from, like, some darkness of the universe. So, as far as, do you really think there's some truth ingrained in these stories on some level?
I do. Even if you only take it as far as Lovecraft, I think reading his stories, there's an authenticity and a genuineness, the way he wrote them, that lends itself to the subject matter. And by that I mean, Lovecraft believes it himself, at least in the framework of the story, or his protagonist, or the narrator. He believes that, the world isn't quite the way we assume it is, and it's very dreamy a lot of times. Most of the main people in the stories are artists of some kind, artists or writers. And they're very creative, they're very into their own selves and their own dreamlike worldviews and things like that. And they get hints of maybe something beyond our human understanding. And that just kind of sucks you in, because at one point Lovecraft is basically telling you through all the people, the narrators, maybe the newspaper reports in the stories, that these strange things are happening, but they can't be, there must be a way to explain them all. They can't be, actually monsters from outside. It must be a rational explanation there somewhere. But the deeper you get into the stories, you find out that at the end, there can't be any logical, rational explanation. It all is darkness and chaos and things that man was not meant to know, and the more we do find out of this forbidden knowledge, the more, I don't know, wisdom we get, but the more annihilation it does to our soul or our mind or consciousness or way of life or way of thinking about ourselves.
So when it comes to the cult of Cthulhu, their main, well, let's say from the stories, their menaces, they're like followers of Cthulhu, who is like the central god or alien god of all the monsters. Well, if you could tell us about Cthulhu, who he is or it is, actually.
Sure. Cthulhu is probably the most popular and widely recognized godlike being in Lovecraft's fiction. And Cthulhu, sometimes called Great Cthulhu or Dread Cthulhu, he's a godlike being that is something like a man and an octopus or squid and a dragon. So some vaguely-sized, demonic leviathan or something, with wings that is trapped beneath the ocean and sleeping, or dead, but still dreaming. So he's asleep. He's in sort of a slumbering state. And one day, his worshippers and his followers will awaken him. And then on that day, he'll rise up and, all hell will break loose. Literally. Probably the most famous tale is The Call of Cthulhu. And that goes into a lot of detail about Cthulhu and what his worshippers want and what they're after and what Cthulhu means to them. And really, that's the key story where Lovecraft really talks about how the Old Ones came to be and visited Earth and how worshippers interact with them and, why human beings and Earth might be of any kind of value or importance whatsoever. Those other stories sort of brush on these things. You mentioned, like, Nyarlathotep and Azathoth and the fabled Necronomicon in passing. But in The Call of Cthulhu, that Lovecraft story, he really gets into detail of, like, old Castro said this, and several worshippers before they died declared that about the Great Old Ones. And so that's really his master tale. It's quite a long short story, almost a novella.
And the Necronomicon book, which of course there's a lot of urban legend around it, there's that Simon copy that goes around. You can find it at bookstores and New Age sections. And it's been passed around, and there are some people that actually believe, use it as a magic system. I've messed around with it before, back in my wilder days, and I had some strange experiences with it. And there's definitely something peculiar about that book, the Necronomicon. I've heard many stories about people just having weird things happen to them from that book. But it's funny because I'm remembering from the documentary today that a lot of writers, they knew that he made the Necronomicon he created it, and they passed it around in their horror stories with stories around it, like Robert Bloch. I think he did some stories. Stephen King's had stories with the Necronomicon in it, and countless writers. And it's funny how H.P. Lovecraft inspired so many writers, and since he passed away, that they kind of kept him alive. And, I mean, he's influenced so much. It's just amazing how many writers he's influenced and inspired in movies, from The Thing with John Carpenter that was basically in the mouth of madness. I mean, not in the mouth of madness, at the Mountains of Madness. Another one, In the Mouth of Madness, that was kind of Lovecraftian, I think, definitely. And just so many movies, Hellboy, just so many that he's inspired and influenced, just that power that he has, which adds more to the scope of just his strength as a writer.
Yes. In fact, he's become so such a powerful influence, not only, like you said, on fiction, but also on cinema, that we're getting into a phase now where the original films that were very inspired or straight adaptations of Lovecraft's works are now being remade. For instance, I just today saw the movie Fright Night, which was really good. But before that, I saw the preview to the remake of The Thing, like you mentioned, which is directed by John Carpenter, came out in the 80s. So they're remaking The Thing now, and they're probably going to remake, there was The Dunwich Horror, which came out in the 70s, I think, and a couple years ago, they remade that. So there's two movies of The Dunwich Horror, and, it's just going to continue, because horror, you can only have so many great horror ideas. I mean, you can do horror in a number of different ways, infinite number of ways, but at its core, a certain premise or plot or, a narrative device within horror can only go so far, or, there only could be so many formulas for that. And, Lovecraft used each one of the formulas that he used very, very well. And so if people want to go back to the really great uses of the horror genre, then going back to the source, which is Lovecraft, just seems like a no-brainer. And so it's no surprise that writers and artists and filmmakers are going back to H.P. Lovecraft to find out what real horror is, and, the dark underbelly beneath all the horror that we know and love and read and watch on TV and in the movie theater.
Yeah, I was disappointed to hear that Guillermo del Toro's At the Mountains of Madness was canceled. I was so mad.
Yeah.
I heard that was canceled. Christ, that's just stupid. What are they thinking? That would have been excellent.
Yeah. But, that's Hollywood, and someone's going to pick it up again in a couple of years, and then maybe, who knows, maybe they'll do a better job than he would have done. I don't know.
All right, well, let's...
not the second one.
His first writing success was Dagon, and I've seen that film by Stuart Gordon, and, man, it was great. But if you could tell us, Dagon revolves around Cthulhu. I'm getting tongue-tied there. Well, could you tell us about Dagon, what that story is about, pretty much?
Sure. Yeah, that movie came out, maybe 10 years ago now?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, it was filmed, I believe, somewhere in South America or Brazil or someplace like that. So it's filmed on location, and it's based on... it's actually based on the story of Dagon, but Shadow over Innsmouth. Because there's all these people, this fishing town, that are sort of hybrids between humans and the deep ones, or these sort of frog, fish-like people, or race that comes from the sea. And there's very strong ties from them to Dagon, which is their god, their sort of anthropomorphic fish god. And then Dagon has some influence or some ties to Cthulhu himself. And we didn't really talk that much about Cthulhu in Dagon, which is the Shadow over Innsmouth. But, there's a relation there, and it's all kind of tied together a little bit. But that's what the Cthulhu mythos is, and that's why it's cool, because nothing is totally concrete or set in stone. One thing kind of bleeds into another, and sometimes a thing appears almost out of nowhere, and then it's linked to this other thing from this other writer or artist, and it's just like a patchwork quilt, and it just kind of goes in whatever organic direction that creative people want to take it.
So what do you think his fascination was with fish and tentacles and the ocean? Why do you think he had that fascination?
Well, he was a New Englander. He was, I believe, born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island. And there was a short period of time when he lived in New York, and then also a short period of time when he did some traveling to different places in the United States, maybe abroad. But most of the time he spent in New England. And so he definitely had an affinity for the ocean and the sea, things like that. I believe he was either allergic or had some sort of aversion to seafood. So he was kind of repulsed by creatures, like eating creatures that came from the sea. And there's just something about tentacles, maybe, that is kind of frightening and weird, and you don't know where it comes from. It's definitely not human. I think maybe he saw space or time or maybe the areas between dimensions as sort of watery or sort of ethereal, having like a thick kind of atmosphere that you can swim through. And maybe it makes sense that if there are creatures that come from either a different dimension or that are traveling in between dimensions, that maybe, if travel between dimensions is like traveling through water or the ocean or something like that, that maybe those creatures are aquatic or, like a squid or something like that.
I know one of the writers today said on the documentary they're talking about his sexuality, and they made the parallel of Cthulhu in a vagina, which I'm not saying I agree with that, but it made me laugh out loud. They're like, people trying to sit back and decipher all of his stuff, and someone was like, actually, yeah, Cthulhu is sexuality and the female vagina, and they're like trying to decipher all this stuff, and it cracked me up. But so many people have so many different perceptions of what he was writing about. Like, some people think that, he had some, xenophobia and a little bit of racism as far as against immigrants. And, he seemed to not like the idea of other, races mixing and stuff like that. That it kind of played into his stories a little bit. It was pretty compelling. What do you think about that?
Definitely. I think so much of what Lovecraft was about and what he thought and felt and who he was as a person went into his stories, that sometimes it's crazy or scary. And I think people that investigate Lovecraft and who he was and why he wrote things, people like S.D. Joshi or Robert M. Price, Lovecraft scholars, really there's so much material out there. He very much a prude when it came to sexual matters. And I think that, if you read it in that kind of way, there's a wealth of material on, different kinds of human sexuality. And, you can see things with the tentacles and, bulbous, protrusions and, slimy cavities and nauseous odors and, and squelchy, underfooting and I don't know, nothing extremely specific is coming to mind, but I've noticed that too, that, when he layers description upon description of maybe a place or a thing, sometimes there's definitely a sexual element there. As the sort of xenophobia or racism, I definitely think that back in the 1920s and 30s, Lovecraft was seeing America, and especially New England, change. The whole, just the makeup of of who was coming to the United States, and especially when he went to New York for a short period of time, he was just shocked that, you know, people didn't look like he did, that there were so many, you know, Italians and Greeks and people speaking a different language. And, you know, the way it wasn't that Lovecraft was just like, you know, oh, I hate anybody that's different than me, or, you know, the usual kind of racism that we see now. I think that he was just afraid, because it was the unknown. He was just afraid of people that didn't look like him, that didn't speak like him, that didn't think like him, and he was already such an outsider his whole life, that if now he was living in a world where he actually felt physically alien to the rest of the species that inhabited it, that was almost too much for him. And that, you know, if you saw people walking down the street that were from a different ethnicity, that spoke a different language, that had completely different customs and cultures, were from a different place, and, you know, looked different, you know, that repulsed him, because it just threw his alienness and his own outsideness into sharp relief, and it was just something that he had a hard time dealing with. So it was his own issue. It wasn't really like, you know, like, oh, I hate minorities because they're lazy, or, you know, something like that. It was just that he was just afraid, and then that fear came out in the stories. But if you look at the stories, they glorify things like the great old ones and the people that worship him, and those people that worship him, those are the, you know, the swarthy foreigners and the people of mixed heritage and foreign descent and things like that. So really, in a way, those are the heroes or anti-heroes of the stories. So it's not like, you know, every criminal or bad person was of a different race than him. I think he secretly glorified those people because they were living a life that was fantastical and extraordinary, and that he couldn't. You know, he was confined to the boring old stupid reality that everybody else is. So.
And I know we know there was only one relationship that he was in, and he married her, Sonia Heff Green. What do you know about that? As far as was that his only relationship that he was ever in?
I believe that was his only. He married her, so that was his only serious, intimate adult relationship. Yes.
And it ended badly, apparently, in divorce.
It did end, you know, it did end in divorce. A lot of people, you know, talk about Lovecraft's anti-Semitism. Like, again, that's just, he had Jewish friends. In fact, Sonia Green was Jewish. And, you know, a lot of people that respected his work and that he collaborated with, things like that, were also Jewish. So, again, it wasn't the fact that he was, you know, just in the mood to hate Jews or something like that. He was just afraid that there was a difference. And he wanted to feel pride in what he had, because there wasn't much he had except, you know, his own blood and his own heritage, which was kind of being, you know, wiped away by the death of his family and the loss of any kind of fortune he had, and the changing of who was making up New England, you know. He didn't focus on sex overtly. He didn't talk about sex, you know. In the 1920s and 30s, of course, things were more conservative. But even by those standards, like I said, Lovecraft is very prudish. And I think that's, again, where you get a lot of the subtext of sexuality in his work. Because he didn't overtly talk or even think or fantasize about sex. A lot of that stuff you know, might have gone into his dreams, and then from his dreams they went into his stories, and maybe because he wasn't even thinking about sex at the time, some of his descriptions sound extremely sexual. But yeah, he divorced her, I think mainly because she wanted to keep working in New York and running a business. And he, for the life of him, couldn't find a decent job in New York. He didn't have much of a formal education. I think he just graduated from high school, barely. He didn't have any kind of college degree, even though he was a genius on some levels. You know, reading and writing Latin when he was like 5 years old and writing the stories that he did. But yeah, he couldn't find work, and he wanted to move back to New England, and his wife wanted to continue, you know, running a hat shop or something like that, or women's clothing in New York. And they just decided it was better to part ways. So they got a divorce.
It happens. I've been down that road.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm actually gonna go down the beginning of that road. Hopefully I won't go the full divorce route very soon, actually in a month from now. I'm getting married, so kind of excited about that.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is your first time being married?
It is. It is.
We have one child
together, and that's what kind of precipitated the engagement in the first place, is that we already had one child, and we want to have more children, and I don't know. Our families, and she is very conservative, at least more so than I am. I'd be just happy to just be and just have the relationship without any kind of, you know, documentation or whatever. But she wants to, you know, get married, and I can understand that. And it would be good for the children, I suppose, too, so.
Yeah, I have a girlfriend now. We live together, and neither of us really care about getting married, but I've been married before, and it ended badly. But, yeah, I mean, it can work out. I mean, as far as just, like, you know, depends on your view on it, and women kind of like that kind of thing more than guys, it seems, anyway. So, I mean, you know, if they want to do it, if she came up to me and wanted to do it, I would do it, but I don't ever foresee her wanting to do that. But what do you think he meant on his tombstone when he said, "I am Providence"?
Well, actually, I wondered that too, but I think I found out, I heard a couple of years ago, that he didn't actually put that on there.
Oh, really?
Either friends of his or people later. I can't remember when it was, but it was people that knew him or that loved his work later on, I guess, chipped in for the money and decided that that he needed some grave marker that was more substantial or befitting his literary career. And so they got him that other tombstone, which says, "I am Providence." And that's, you know, that's more well-known than... Because I think there's... I've actually been there to his gravesite. I think there's also a vault where him and his other relatives might be, but there's also the tombstone that says, "I am Providence." Because I don't think he had that high of an opinion of himself and his work while he was alive. I think he feared that a lot of his work was relegated to the memories of people that read them in weird tales and astounding stories. And then when those people died, Lovecraft's work would die with them. And, which is kind of sad and not at all true, obviously, because, you know, August Derleth, his friend, and Donald Wandry created Arkham House in order to keep Lovecraft's tales in circulation and allow them to survive and grow and, you know, influence other writers and artists and whatnot. So
yeah, he seemed to have, like, self-esteem issues. And I saw in the documentary that he kind of aspired to be like, you know, some of the, I forget, there was a writer that kind of influenced him, Lord Dunsany.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that Lord Dunsany kind of messed around with the, you know, gods and stuff like that, and I think, you know, that definitely, do you know how that exactly, what he admired about Lord Dunsany so much?
I think just the fantasy and just the dreamlike tales and the dreamlike quality of his writing and his willingness to just go into weird flights of fantasy and that's one of his sources that I've never really gotten that much into. I've never read that much of. You know, he was definitely influenced by him and, of course, Edgar Allan Poe, which I have read a lot of. Robert W. Chambers, who I've read a little bit of, but not a lot. So I think, I don't know precisely why he loved Lord Dunsany, but I know he liked, like, fantasy things. I think that was a big part of Lord Dunsany's work.
And I saw that he really digged on Bram Stoker's Dracula a lot. That was one that he really liked, Dracula.
Yeah. Oh. I think even in Gothic, he really liked, you know, because he was very much into the supernatural in his taste in literature. The Gothicness and then the supernatural and magical, you know, anything with, like, wizards and warlocks and witches, things like that. Anything like that he liked, I think. So,
I know I saw a movie about Robert E. Howard. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it had Renee Zellweger in it and the guy from The Cell, that movie The Cell. And Robert E. Howard was, like, writing letters back and forth, and Lovecraft was, like, helping him and stuff. And,
This is a movie?
Yeah, it's a movie. I can't remember the name of it, though, but Renee Zellweger's in it, and the dude, he's on a law show on, like, regular TV and stuff. I can't remember, but he's Vincent D'Onofrio or whatever's in it. He plays Robert E. Howard, and the movie's really good, even though it's kind of weird. But, of course, Robert E. Howard, at the end of the movie, shoots himself. But during it, he talks about getting letters from H.P. Lovecraft, and it's a good movie. You can probably find the name of it on IMDb. I have it burned somewhere. I just can't for the life of me remember. But, yeah, it's pretty good. It's definitely worth checking out. It's called Kite. I can't remember the name of it.
Watch it and try to Google it right now, so hang on.
But it's got Renee Zellweger and that dude from The Cell, Vincent D'Onofrio.
The whole white guy?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
it's worth checking out. And just to see Robert E. Howard and him and her, like, always fighting, and he's, like, always just crazy talking about Conan and slicing dragons. And if you ever get a chance, check it out. It's worth the watch. Definitely. It's a good one.
Yeah, I love Robert E. Howard, too. It's such a tragedy that he committed suicide after his mother died. And that's, he was young, too. He was, like, in his early 30s, I think.
Yeah.
So,
the actor does a really good job of playing him, that dude, Vincent D'Onofrio, I believe is his name.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I'll check that out.
And it's weird right now. I'm thinking of all those little Cthulhu dolls and stuff. People are crazy over this stuff. They love it. I love it. I don't have, like, little dolls. If I could afford a little doll, I would.
Yeah. When our baby gets a little older, we're definitely going to buy her, like, a Cthulhu plushie and probably not a Lofoten cat. Whatever else we come up with. Yeah.
And there's just... so many There's that comic book, Strange Adventures of H.P. Lovecraft. They were going to do a movie about that, but I think it got canned. It's hard to find good H.P. Lovecraft movies. They're out there, like, the, you know, Reanimator and all that stuff. I watched today that movie Cthulhu, the newest one that came out a few years ago, where it starts off using, it was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't bad compared to some of the other ones I've seen. It was pretty good. Okay. It's just called Cthulhu.
Yeah, I know about it. I just haven't seen it myself.
Yeah, it's worth the watch. It definitely.
Seen
Tori Spelling was in it. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, I knew she was in that. Yeah.
She's actually kind of hot. It. She was trying to get into the banger so they could make little Cthulhu babies.
Nice.
He's like, hey. He's gay in the movie, and he's like, no, I'm gay.
Yeah. That's another theme of his stories, is the progeny, the progenation of, creating another race of beings, different entities, copulating with, maybe human women, implanting his seed in some vessel. And then the deep ones, sort of interspecies, liaisons with human beings. So there's a lot of that going around. Just creating different spawn. I played the role playing game, but the Call of Cthulhu. The Masks of Nyarlathotep is a very cool, very long, world-spanning campaign book. A lot of that has to do with, the old ones and their servitors or monsters and things like that, having sex with different worshippers. Vessels and sacrifices and women and things like that, in order to create like a new race of being who will then usher in the great old ones. So
ufology, UFOs and aliens and stuff, like, which is some topics we cover pretty heavily, and weirdly we go pretty deep with that stuff a lot. But there's a lot of stories about aliens making hybrid children, and a lot of the stuff like that reminds me of that. Some of those, stories you read in UFO books about, hybrid aliens and weird, people being abducted, and then they see little hybrid aliens running around, and the aliens are like, these are your children.
where the human species came from, and if our own evolution was influenced by beings outside, maybe the great old ones, maybe some extraterrestrial godlike beings, and then they visit Earth at some point, the whole ancient astronaut theory, Chariot of the Gods, that whole thing.
All right, Avenger, we're about to go on break, and then we'll take a little 10-minute break, and you stay by the phone, and then we'll come back and do the rest of the show. If you could, what's your link real quick for people if they want to take a look at your site real quick?
Oh, okay. Yeah, cultofcthulhu.net.
Okay,
if you're trouble spelling that, just Google it. We're all over the place. It's not too far, hard to find us. If you want to know anything about me specifically, just Google Venger, Satanus, and then Bob's your uncle.
All righty, well, let's go to break, and we'll come back with our H.P. Lovecraft Tribute of the Weird. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back in a bit.
Thank you.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montalvo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Church of Mavis with our guest, Venger Satanus. Tonight's topic is H.P. Lovecraft, Cult of Cthulhu, Tribute of the Weird. That's right. That's how we do it. Moshing with the apocalypse tonight as Irene's pounding the shores and weird earthquakes and missing co-hosts. So hopefully Guy Whittle's okay. Hopefully there's been no medical situation. I think it may be a computer problem. I don't know, but we'll figure that out. We haven't heard from him yet, so definitely a little peculiar. So, Venger, if you could, I find it fascinating that you counsel people, and it kind of revolves around the H.P. Lovecraft belief system that you teach at your website. If you could, how does that work exactly?
Sure. Well, my role as, first I was the high priest, and now I'm the exorcist of the Cthulhu cult. And my role for that is kind of a teacher, kind of a mentor. Some people go so far as to describe me as a messiah figure in one way or another. And I like to help people, you know, I like to give them advice, allow them the benefit of whatever wisdom I've collected in my life. And so, you know, and I have a reputation for knowing certain things and getting things. And so people come to me, for either my expertise or just advice or somewhere to talk to. Or to learn from. And so I kind of wanted to combine the Cthulhu mythos aspects of the cult of Cthulhu and everything that entails with kind of an Anthony Robbins sort of life coaching, mentoring kind of feel or aspect. So some people, I have certain clients that come to me and, you know, they want me to give them life coaching sessions and talk to them and advise them. And so I do that as well as, you know, writing and painting and leading the cult and all the other things that I do.
So personally, how do you feel about Cthulhu? Do you really think there's a being that embodies that's going to return?
That's a good question. On one hand, I do believe because I want to believe. And then for me, that's good enough. And that might seem strange, but I think if a person believes in a thing, then that can become the reality. And that's, you know, a person's reality is their reality. And there's very little difference between the objective reality that a few different people can point to and be like, oh, that's real, and someone's personal subjective reality where an individual can say, this is real. You know, where do you draw the line? What's the difference between the two? I don't think there is much difference. So from that standpoint, yes, Cthulhu is real, because I say he is real. From another point of view, I think there's a lot of stuff going on in Lovecraft's work, a lot of stuff beneath the surface. I and a lot of other cultists consider Lovecraft to be a prophet of sorts, and that he was either channeling or directing or intuiting knowledge, maybe from his dreams or just from his creative juices. And he poured that into his fiction, and a lot of it has a deep resonance with, you know, the universe and how that works and what lies beyond that and people's inner life. All the different things that Lovecraft went on about, like astral space and traveling through dimensions and the things that are outside our reality, all that stuff. So
when it comes to the Necronomicon, he actually named certain deities in certain belief systems or pantheons, as far as like Marduk and, I don't even think if I said that right, Marduk and Tiamat, and like these gods are like in Sumerian and Mesopotamian, and, you know, like these are actual gods on some level that influenced him on some level, correct?
No, that's all like the Simon Necronomicon stuff.
Yeah.
That's stuff that the publisher of the Simon Necronomicon, Simon, I guess, used to kind of bolster or add on to Lovecraft's idea of the Necronomicon. So, I mean, Lovecraft may have been inspired by ancient Sumerian or Mesopotamian mythology, but no more than Christianity or anything he might have learned about Indian gods or Greek gods or Roman gods or anything like that. So I personally don't put much stock into Marduk and Tiamat and whoever else from the Simon Necronomicon. I own a copy, but I don't really practice that kind of magic. I don't really put much stock into it just because it doesn't resonate with me personally. So I don't use it.
So I didn't realize that there was apparently there was like H.P. Lovecraft's version of, you know, the original version of the Necronomicon, and then I guess other people added all that other crap onto it. I didn't realize that. So is there a copy of H.P. Lovecraft's original Necronomicon that's not been touched anywhere? Is it easy to get?
No. Well, he's got one essay called History of the Necronomicon, and then seeded throughout his stories, there's little snippets here and there. Like there's the couplet that goes, "That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die." Like apparently that is a direct quote from somewhere in the Necronomicon. A lot of other stuff is hinted at and alluded to, and maybe there's snippets here and there, and, you know, of course the Necronomicon mentions Great Cthulhu, it mentions Yog-Sothoth, and, you know, maybe the role that human beings play in the rise of the Great Old Ones. But there really isn't a text where Lovecraft went into serious detail for pages and pages of, like, what the Necronomicon is, what it's about. It's all meant to be off stage and off camera and visualized by the reader and the dreamer and the artists.
So Into the Mountains of Madness. What can you tell? Can you tell us about that story? It's very, very fascinating.
Sure. It's an Arctic expedition where they uncover the Elder Things, these very strange-looking. They're frozen in ice. Some are dead. Some are not. Then they find this walled city underneath the earth in the Arctic, or beneath this mountain, or inside the mountain, maybe. And through different pictures and reliefs on the walls of the city, it tells the history of the Elder Things and the Old Ones and how they got on or didn't get on with each other, and the creation of the Chagoths, and then try to get to the surface. They barely escape, and giant penguin, and yeah.
And
the way I'm relating it, you know, it's, I don't know, it probably sucks. But from my recollection, those are the highlights.
And they look like cucumbers, and they were like involved in some ancient war too, and got cast down the earth or something, and that's how like humanity found them or inherit them, so to speak, right, or something like that.
Yeah. So yeah, sometimes Lovecraft contradicted himself just a little bit with who the Elder Things are, who exactly the Old Ones are, and how they fit in with each other, and what that has to do with, you know, the grand scheme of things, and other beings. And of course, other writers like August Derleth, and, you know, everybody between H.P. Lovecraft and August Derleth put their two cents in about, you know, who the Old Ones were, their relation to the Elder Gods, and the Elder Things, and, I don't know. It's just, it gets convoluted and very confusing. It just depends on who you read.
So when it comes to humanity and all these stories, it seems like the end result is insanity. Is that what the end result is? That these beings, do they care about us on any level, or they just want us to be insane and follow them? Is that the final result of every story?
A lot of times the result is either insanity or death, yes. But keep in mind that most protagonists or the narrators in Lovecraft stories are not the worshippers, but they are the straight-laced skeptics that are the farthest from believing in any kind of supernatural or alien entity at the beginning of these stories. But towards the end, their whole paradigm, their whole world belief system is shattered by the recognition that these things are actually real. And so that leads to either a breakdown or suicide, or, you know, being committed to a mental institution, or, you know, perhaps being killed by worshippers who don't want to be thwarted by, you know, certain investigations, etc.
So, I know both of H.P. Lovecraft's parents went crazy and got put into asylums, didn't they? One of them, his father died from syphilis, too, correct?
Yeah, I think that's the prevalent theory, is that he did somehow contract syphilis, and it led to madness and the deterioration of his brain, his mental functions. And he did have to go to insane asylum, and I think he did die there, yes. As for his mother, I don't know. I think she was kind of crazy or neurotic. I don't know if she was ever committed. I think so, but she did die when he was fairly young. So, I don't know, his family life probably had something to do with screwing him up, but I think he was a weird cat just from the get-go. So,
yeah, she definitely
had...
if a mom's going to go around telling neighbors her kid's ugly, she's definitely got some kind of issue. You know, hey, my little boy's ugly. He's got an ugly head.
I don't think
definitely some issues there.
Yeah. I don't think the documentary mentioned it, but I read that Lovecraft's mother to look like a girl until he was at least 5 years old. Because I think she originally wanted a girl. And she got, you know, Howard Phillips Lovecraft, who's a boy. And so she dressed him and grew his hair long like a girl until he was at least 5, I think. Now that seems batshit crazy to us. And of course it is. But I also think I heard from someone else that that wasn't common, but it wasn't as rare or as bizarre as we would think it is today. But every once in a while it actually did happen. And so it wasn't the outright travesty of, you know, God's law that we think it is today. Like, oh my God, I can't even believe that. So it did happen back then. But it was pretty rare. It just goes to show, again, how Lovecraft never really had a chance at being a normal person.
Yeah, well, as crazy and kind of sad that he had to go through all this, if it wasn't for all this, and he probably never would have wrote these beautiful, dark masterpieces. He would have never created them. That's the kind of stuff that kind of fuels the passion and the insanity. If it wasn't for all that, we wouldn't have an H.P. Lovecraft, even though it sucks. But if it wasn't for that chaos and oblivion and darkness, then we wouldn't be here discussing them, I think.
That's very true.
I can relate. I had an abusive dad, a beat cancer, many failed relationships, and it all builds character and builds who you are. So, I mean, I could see how that would make him escape into these, you know, stories that are genius on so many levels. What do we know about his death? Let's talk about his death.
Okay. Well, actually, there were two things trying to kill him. Deathbed, I guess in 1937. That's the year he died. I believe it was Bright's disease and also cancer. Maybe intestinal cancer. And I think it's very interesting because, you know, someone like Lovecraft is so unique on Earth and in the universe, I guess, that it just seems like the world or the universe or nature doesn't want him. You know, they want him out. And the more he's creating this fantastical, unnatural, anti-cosmic literature, the more the world just wants to get rid of him. And so I think it's kind of maybe a little funny and poetic that but there were two things that were trying to compete for killing Lovecraft off at a fairly young age. I mean, I guess he was 46. Well, that's not, I mean, that's fairly young, especially by today's standards. But
46, wow, that's young. I mean, that's, he could have, you know, went on for many more, you know, decades writing. But I guess all that, you know, stuff he went through, you know, had to add to his medical state on some level. And then, of course, his reclusiveness and loneliness and only talking to a lot of people just through letters only, and a lot of toil and, you know, loneliness is a killer on many levels. I know during the last part of his life, the last part, he started traveling a lot, didn't he? Because I saw they show pictures in the documentary of him hanging out with other writers, and he, like, visited Florida and a bunch of other places. He started kind of getting around a little bit more, didn't he?
Yes, towards the end of his life. He kind of got over his hermitness, hermit qualities, his, I guess, I would say he had agoraphobia, you know, fear of open places and outside, things like that. Yeah, he visited places like that. I think he visited, like, New Orleans and maybe even Canada, someplace in the West, I believe. Yeah, I think he did a lot of traveling, went kind of all over, at least for him. And he just sort of got out of his shell. Towards the end of his life, he kind of became a different person. I guess maybe he became his own person, which is kind of cool. Politically, he was very conservative, almost to sort of a fascist, or very nationalistic, aristocratic standard, early in his life. But towards the end of his life, I think he kind of embraced socialism and notions of progress and maybe trying to build a better society than what we have now. So he kind of went through a change of hearts or a change of mind, a metanoia, if you will, which really, I think, influenced not only his writing, but because in the last 2 years of his life, he wrote The Shadow Art of Time, and I can't think of what else like either.
Didn't he write that Charles Dexter Ward towards the end of his life? I know.
That could well be. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, and so he traveled more, and yeah, he really opened up. I think he was very personable with writers in person and other people. You know, there were other people that admired his work. He didn't have a huge fan base. You know, he had a few readers in the pulp magazines. But he had a lot of fellow writers that really respected him and liked what he did. And so, yeah, he got to meet some of those in person and talk with them. And, so I think it was a great thing. And it was tragic that he died that young and couldn't go on to write more and more masterpieces like the stuff we have now.
Yeah, I mean, he thought so lowly of himself, but, I mean, now he's a legend. I mean, he really is a legend. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Yes, he is very much a legend.
A legend of horror. So let's get, as far as your Cult of Cthulhu, is there a magic, do you do like magic and stuff?
Yep, there is magic involved, definitely. My own personal definition of magic is willed change. So if an individual or a magician can create sort of change in either their own subjective or objective reality, then by their own will, and according to their own will, then that in itself is magic. And just a person on my forum, they called it Cthulhu Forum just a day ago, or maybe it was my YouTube channel, I can't remember. They were asking, so, would, like, dieting be magic? I thought about it for a second, and then I was just like, well, yeah, if you were to go on some sort of, I don't know, fat loss diet or something like that, or muscle building diet, or whatever kind of diet you wanted to have to bring whatever changes to your body you wanted, and you did it successfully, then that would itself be magic, because you're changing something through your own will, you know, you have your desire, and then you put your desire into practice, you know, with your will. And that's what magic is. That's what changing reality is all about. So, yeah, there's definitely systems of magic. There isn't any one concrete system. You have to practice it this way, absolutely. It's very much up to the individual practitioner. So in that way, it's a lot like chaos magic. You take what you want, and you leave the rest. Whatever you find aesthetically pleasing, whatever resonates with you, you should do that. And whatever you don't like, you don't think works for you, you think it's just a hassle or something, then don't use that. Just leave it out or change it. And, yeah, that's the system magic we have in the cult.
So when it comes to Cthulhu returning, I know there's that, I'm sure you've seen that Facebook event that, you know, that talks about him returning on December 21st, 2012, and there's like a million people on it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, supposedly there's, you know, the Mayans say that Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent god, is supposed to return at that time, too. There's some kind of, I've heard people talk about vortex is supposed to open and some lizard god or something is supposed to come through. But when it comes to, like, for instance, in the film Cthulhu that I saw today, basically they were, this family, they were, you know, wanting the old ones to come back in Cthulhu, and basically they were given eternal life. And that's what they said that would be their gift, and they would all go into the ocean, I guess, and live with it and be immortal forever. Is that what the promise of Cthulhu is, eternal life?
I believe so. Not on this earth, but I believe that human beings have the potential to become gods themselves, or at least their essence or soul or energy has the potential to live on past the death of their bodies into a new dimension, a new world they pass on to, a new universe, and that's possible by working on yourself and, you know, awakening, you know, following some sort of specific path or magical avenue, worshiping the old ones, things like that. So, yeah, I believe that godhood or self-deification is possible, and I think that's a potential gift to us by the great old ones, and that people should try to learn and take hold of that and use it, because it's available if people want, but most people even don't think about it, don't care about it, or just ignorant of the possibilities.
Well, there's some haunting similarities to Cthulhu and the Lovecraft belief system. So, like, let's say, for instance, the ancient astronaut theory, that I believe that we were put here by other beings, that God is an alien, so to speak, and that we were seated here and colonized and basically, you know, dropped off to colonize the Earth. And on some level, there's some haunting parallels to the ancient astronaut theory that I believe that, you know, all these ancient civilizations, if you've seen Ancient Aliens on the History Channel from Eric Von Daniken and all that stuff, that there is some weird similarities to this and Lovecraft's system. Except Lovecraft's belief system, it seems like the old ones and all that are like creepy kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say evil necessarily, but I guess that they are on some level. Is there, in the Lovecraft mythos, or the belief system, are there good beings?
Well, Lovecraft described them, or one of his characters described them, as being beyond good and evil. So, I think they operate in just a different frequency than human beings, and they just, so it's hard for us to talk about them in terms of good and evil.
Yeah.
I think their hearts, the great old ones, have positive aspects for, concerning humanity. And I also believe there are forces out there that are very hostile to beings and life in general on our planet. So, And August Derleth talked about a war or a conflict between some beings which were good and some beings which were evil. But, I don't know. He kind of takes a different tack because I guess August Derleth was a Catholic. And so anything like the great old ones, Cthulhu or Yog-Sothoth, you know, to someone like August Derleth would probably be evil. But it depends on what you mean by evil. You know, if evil is taking on the status quo, then yeah, the great old ones are evil, I suppose. But if evil is, you know, trying to imprison or destroy mankind, then no, I don't think the great old ones are evil. I don't think that's what they're trying to do.
So who exactly is Yog-Sothoth? You know, these names, man, they're tongue twisters. Who exactly is the Yagoth, exactly?
Well, a lot of the main entities are Cthulhu, that's the most recognizable one. Then Yog-Sothoth, he's pretty recognizable as well. And Yog-Sothoth is the gate, Yog-Sothoth is the key, Yog-Sothoth is the key and guardian of the gate. Then there's Azathoth, the demon sultan, with his little beings fluting and piping madly surrounding him in some sort of weird dance or something. Then there's Nyarlathotep, of course, who is very much identified with like ancient Egypt and the Black Pharaoh, things like that, the Crawling Chaos. Nyarlathotep has many forms, as many as a thousand different forms, or aspects, or avatars. Then there's other gods, which some are borrowed from other writers, like Hastur and Sathagua, and Shub-Niggurath, of course. Dagon, he's kind of a lesser god. He's not at the status of like Cthulhu and Yog-Sothoth, but certainly Dagon and I suppose Mother Hydra. I think she's in the story.
These names, man, where did he get them? Did he just make a lot of them up? They're just totally bizarre.
I think he made a lot of them up. Some are maybe hybrids of different things that Lovecraft picked up or heard, or maybe, you know, maybe some entity sent certain impressions to Lovecraft while he was dreaming, and then he wrote them down. So maybe the entities told him what they're called. I don't know. That's a possibility.
So in the magic system, I know in magic systems there's people who've summoned, you know, angelic beings and demons and things like that. Do you think these beings are connected to some of these, like, angels and demons from, like, other belief systems? Like, you know, who would be the Lucifer of the Cthulhu mythos, so to speak? Or would it be Cthulhu?
Well, some people try to make certain correspondences between the mythos entities and other things we're more familiar with. But I don't know if there's any system of correspondences that really match up with
yeah.
these guys. You know, sometimes people try to, you know, put the planets or certain colors or elements or different signs or, you know, even use Enochian to try to, you know, conceptualize these beings. But it's really hard to do, and I think the Cthulhu mythos defies that, defies the conceptualization of these beings, because they're not meant to be kept in a box, you know, just like chaos. They jump out of the box whenever they feel like it, and then they stay out of there, and they do their own thing, and they interact with whoever they want to with different artists, and they're reimagined and reconceptualized all the time, in the consciousness of new artists and new writers and new filmmakers, musicians and such.
That's something I wanted to touch base on. I heard them mention in a documentary that there were some bands that kind of touched on some Lovecraft stuff. Do you know any good bands that are worth checking out that sing about H.P. Lovecraft stuff?
Well, I know there's a lot of heavy metal. It depends on the listener. I mean, some people love heavy metal, and some people love the really more extreme versions of that, like black metal or death metal. If you're really into hardcore metal of any kind, I think just by using Google, you can probably find a plethora of H.P. Lovecraft-inspired musicians and bands. I think the Ziggurats is a pretty well-known project, a metal band that does that. That's kind of their whole raison d'etre, is Lovecraft and the mythos and slimy tentacles, etc. If you're into dark ambient music, and that's kind of more my taste, then there are a lot of good things. In fact, there are one or two compilations on CD of dark ambient that are devoted to H.P. Lovecraft. I know a friend of mine, he's on Facebook, The Unquiet Void. He's got several albums and CDs that are super specifically Lovecraft-oriented. I think his latest one might be The Shadow Haunted Outside, which is great.
What's the name of his
The Unquiet Void is the name of his project, and I believe one of his latest albums, the one I think I like the best, is The Shadow Haunted Outside. It's very good. So that's easy to find. But if you just do the Google search for dark ambient and H.P. Lovecraft or Cthulhu Mythos, I think you can find a bunch of stuff, which is great.
Have you heard the Nox Arcana Necronomicon album?
I have. It's really not my cup of tea, but some people like it, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, check it out on YouTube, or I think you can probably find tracks on there just to see if that's your cup of tea. Darkest of the Hillside Thickets takes kind of a humorous approach to Lovecraft's music. I think they've got a lot of like joke songs or like parody songs.
What's the name of them? What's the name of them again? Sorry,
I think Darkest of the Hillside Thickets.
Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. That's a mouthful. I'm going to write that out. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think they've got to it's meant to be funny. Kind of like Weird Al Yankovic or, I don't know, who else does the humor music. But something like that. There's a ton of stuff. When I was a kid, listening to Metallica growing up in the 80s and early 90s. I used to love The Thing That Should Not Be from the Master of Puppets album, which is very Lovecraftian. And The Call of Cthulhu.
Call of Cthulhu.
From Ride the Lightning, that instrumental by Metallica. That's very cool. I also love that too. And it's unfortunate that Cliff Burton, the bassist, the one who died when Metallica was on tour, I think after Master of Puppets, he was a Lovecraft fan, I believe. And so when he died, then a lot of the direct mythos tributes in Metallica's music kind of died with him, which is very sad.
I noticed on that Metallica album they spelled Cthulhu different. That was kind of weird. I didn't get why they did that. I guess copyright issues? I don't know.
Which I don't think anyone had to worry about, because Lovecraft was so easygoing and encouraging of other creative people to borrow from his mythos and take his gods and his books and his, you know, creatures or magic items and places and use them in other people's. And then he would borrow from, you know, from other writers that he knew and worked with and liked. But yeah, I think a lot of people were worried about that, and so they deliberately spelled it weird. But,
is there, what are some other films that are your favorite films as far as Lovecraft's concerned? Yeah, there's some good ones out there, but it seems like they're kind of hard to find. What are some of your favorite films?
One of my favorites is The Haunted Palace. Have you ever seen that one?
What's it called again?
The Haunted Palace.
The Haunted Palace. No, I haven't. I'll have to write that down.
See, it's a very lesser-known film because it's named after a poem of Edgar Allan Poe. And it's one of those Roger Corman, Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe type movies. But the thing is, even though the title of the film is based on a poem, and named the poem of an Edgar Allan Poe poem, it's based on the case of Charles Dexter Ward. So it's a very cool adaptation of the Lovecraft story, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. But you wouldn't know it because it's called The Haunted Palace. But back then, you know, in the 60s, Lovecraft was still relatively unknown for popular audiences. And so I think they used the Edgar Allan Poe shtick because people liked that and they were familiar with him. And yeah, so The Haunted Palace, that's up there. I love that. Dagon, like you mentioned, is awesome. The Dunwich Horror. Is great.
That's an older one, isn't it? Dunwich Horror? Because
yeah.
I did one and it looked crappy.
Yeah. Well, it was not too bad either. But yeah, the older one I like best. Reanimator from Beyond is really, really good. That's another Stuart Gordon one. And Stuart Gordon did another Lovecraft one, Dreams in the Witch House. But he did that for the Masters of Horror series. So it's only about 45 minutes long, but it's still very good.
Stuart Gordon did some masterpiece money. What's From Beyond when they're,
He did From Beyond and Reanimator, and then Dagon.
He's the man. I think he's done the best ones I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And then John Carpenter, of course, has done a lot of good stuff. In the Mouth of Madness, he's very Lovecraftian. The Thing, very Lovecraftian. The Prince of Darkness, I find is very Lovecraftian and one of his best films. I know that's not one that immediately jumps on people's tongues as soon as they hear the word, hear the name John Carpenter. But I think Prince of Darkness is right up there. I think that's awesome. We were talking about the whole ancient astronaut thing, and I don't know if you've ever seen the original black and white Quatermass in the Pits.
Yeah, I've seen those, or at least one of them.
Yeah, I would recommend that. I think the Hammer Film Studio remade